Accession number 10776, Reel 5.
Reel 5.
Well, then I recovered from this relapsing fever, then started to get tummy aches again. So Billy took my appendix out, which I left down in Moe. Got something left bad down there. And then it really was time to go. And that was when we finally packed up and went off via Pua and down to Samoa and then flew back. Then I've done all this bit after that until we got to the leper hospital. Then I came back. And of course, then after that, in Chungking, they said it's time for you to go. And I was really medically sent out. I really just wanted to get back home then.
Would you say that was typical, you know, of the FAU generally, that your health did suffer?
I think a lot of us did, actually, yes.
When I look at your photographs, you all look very emaciated.
Well, yes, you can see that's what surprised me when you said that I didn't look much different, because I was just skin and bone when that photo was taken. That was the one was taken just after we came out of Moe. It was taken in Kunming after we came out of Moe, when I had all these the packet of illnesses like that.
Did the FAU, when you got back to the UK, did they sort of give you good medical?
Oh yes, yes. I was all right, because I only had acute things like that, and I'd picked up. But one or two of us had dysentery, and Eric Waddington had amoebic dysentery, and they were, you know, marvellous really to them. And but I that's speaking of other people, and I don't really quite know what happened. But they gave us a jolly good medical afterwards, and I know they also wrote to my parents and said that I'd been ill. You know, they knew. And they were jolly good about all that side of thing, yes.
How easy did you find it to adapt to normal life, you know, after the war, when you returned?
Not bad at all, really, because the policy was for doctors all to go back to your medical school. So I went back to St Thomas's, you see, and then what I thought was, well, I've learned all this tropical medicine. I'd got my London MB, you see, and I discovered that London University do an MD in tropical medicine. I thought, hey, I'm going to get this, you see. So I went back to Sir Patrick Manson Barr and his crowd at the and did another course, only a three-month course this time, at the School of Tropical Medicine, where by this time it was paludrine was the great thing, you see, for malaria. And I thought, oh, I'm doing fine on this. I really got down to the tropical medicine. Of course, what I'd overlooked was the fact that London University aren't chickens about this sort of thing. When you took an MD in tropical medicine, you had to have an MD in general medicine as well. I'd forgotten all that. I did hopelessly at my medicine paper, and I knew quite well I'd ploughed that, so I gave up that idea. And so then it was, you know, it was really, there wasn't really a break. It was just like going back to medical school again, you see. So it was as though the whole thing that had happened had been in a sort of balloon that had floated away, and then you were back on course again, you see. And then, amazingly enough, you see, also I met up again with Robin Williamson, who started me off on this whole pacifist jaunt, you see. And he was, I still, you see, this missionary thing had got me, and I still didn't know whether, I thought this was the final straw. I certainly knew by then that I wasn't going to be a missionary, but I had no idea what I was going to be, you see, because, but then Robin got this, he was dead keen always to be a country GP, you see, and he got this very nice practice at Nettlebed, just close to Henley, you see, And so when I'd finished, we both finished our course at the same time, he managed to get this GP job, he said, why don't you come and join me, you see? So I put up in digs at the hotel in Nettlebed there and came as assistant to him, you see. And I so loved the job, I just thought, you know, here I am, this is what to do. It was a bit like Mohay again, you know, and it was before the health service, but I didn't like the private practice side of it, you see. But this was in 1947. Well, when the health service came in 48, the whole thing was answered for me, because this was, again, just like hospital or just like FAU work again, and you were paid to do a job, and you got on with it. That was what I liked, you see. So, anyway, then I met Jocelyn. Well, in fact, I knew Jocelyn because we were both in the St. Thomas's Choral Society, you see. And we both had things in common, and we went and got married while I was still working in Nettlebed. And then things turned out that we, although we'd have liked to have stayed down there, they wanted too much money from us for us to settle in there, 'cause we were a bit too broke. So her father was then rector of Gissing, which is in Norfolk, just close to here, you see. And so we heard of this practice at Pulham as a result of that. And, of course, we were then able to go to her father's rectory and put up there. And that's how we came to be here in Pulham. And
has it ever been held against you, you know, the fact that you were a CO?
No.
In your medical career?
No, never. No.
On the other hand, has it been of help to you, do you think, your FAU?
I've never really advertised it. I don't feel inclined to tell people. I'll tell them if they ask, but I don't go out of my way to tell people. I do a bit now, because it's more accepted now. I suppose I've been a bit of a sort of swimmer with the tide, and I don't see why not. Anyway, I think it's silly to swim against the tide unless you've got to. And yes, I find nowadays, if I say that I was a pacifist, I don't like the word conscientious objector. I think it's or a seer. I just say I was a pacifist during the war.
Why didn't you like those words?
I don't know why I don't like them. I just don't like them. Conscientious. It sounds a bit sort of. I don't know. I think those words I associate with the First World War. They're out of date, I think. So I think that's why I don't use them or like them. Yes. And
did you find the actual experience, you know, of working in a unit like the FAU, and particularly that experience in Mohai, where you were dealing with such complicated and varied cases, it would seem, from what you've described, would you think, you know, that was a help for you as a GP?
Yes, enormously, really. It not perhaps from the actual medical or surgical point of view, because things were so extraordinary. But I think it enabled you to just cope with anything that came along. And I've always thought a lot of my fellow doctors have been awfully intolerant of patients and of things that have happened and various things to do with the health service, you know. Whereas I felt myself that I could, well, without boasting, I could sort of take them in my stride, you know. And I think perhaps that experience I had in those years, you know, you feel if you could get through that, you can get through anything. You know, yes. Oh, I think it's helped greatly in that way.
Regarding the FAU, you know, you have told me quite a lot about your feelings about it, but did you get any impression of the efficiency of their organisation in, say, an area like China?
Well, yes. I should think, apart from the American army, I should think probably the FAU were about the only thing that was organised there. The Chinese army was totally disorganised. The health service of the and the legal service and everything else of Western China, then Free China, was totally unorganised. And the FAU, I mind you, I was in the most isolated part, and for a long time while I was in Mohéd, lost contact with the rest of the FAU and what was going on, although they sent their newsletters out. It was marvellously organised, really. One of the things, I think the most impressive thing, was the transport side of it, which, of course, I'd never had anything to do except being transported by it, but they got, I'm not quite sure where their engineering works were, either at Jujing or, I think they were somewhere else actually.
I
think they were out there somewhere in Guiyang, yes.
Guiyang.
Yeah, I think it was. Stan Betterton and people like that were running that. And they were absolutely fantastic how they learnt to convert these chevs and dodges to charcoal burning. And we were using much lower horsepower lorries or trucks than the Chinese army. They'd got big GMC things, each of which had been converted to charcoal burning. But we were getting as good a performance out of our 5-ton Chevys and Dodges as they were with their big GMCs. And in fact, we did the most extraordinary loads. And I mean, that was all, must have been incredible organisation behind that transport side of things. And then the organising of the, I think Logan Shannaman was the chap in Kunming who did the drug warehouse. There was quite a big warehouse there where the drugs all came in, mostly, as I said, Canadian Red Cross. I've got a photo of him somewhere weighing out the drugs on a big Chinese weighing machine, one of these sort of arm things. And there must have been a vast amount of organisation behind all that, invoicing all the things that were coming in, knowing who wanted them, where they were got to be sent, getting the right convoys to take them to the right places. I don't know how any of that was done, but it was done, so I presume there was a pretty efficient organisation behind it all.
And do you think the relationship with the Chinese people was a good one with the FAU? You know, did they actually mix with the people?
Oh, yes, yes. That was the great thing about it, that there was absolutely no kind of... We lived Chinese, really. We might have had galbizas and white faces, but we lived Chinese, and it was great.
I suppose in that era as well, that would have been unusual, wouldn't it, for Europeans or Westerners to have actually lived with
the
Chinese?
Yes, there were, for instance, the postal services had all been run by British people at the top, you know, but they... They lived a different life. They kept their sort of colonialism, whereas it was absolutely, the FA was not colonial. Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Are you still a pacifist today, Pat?
That's a very good question. Yes. Yes. Yes, I think more so. But I've had very little reason to think about it. But with atomic bombs and things, I mean, I'm totally anti-war, and I don't think war solves anything, only makes things worse. So at my age, I mean, I wouldn't be requested to or called up to do anything. But yes, I'm still as convinced as before. Though, had I, it's difficult to say what I, if I thought like I do now, what I would have done in 1943 when I was called up. I might have gone into the RAMC if I'd thought like I do now, but...
That implies a little more compromise with the Army.
Yes, I think I'm able to sort of compromise over that sort of thing. But I certainly wouldn't go and learn any firearms drill or anything like that.
Did you have to carry firearms?
Yeah, you do, yes. I think that was one of my objections to the RAMC. I wouldn't be prepared to use a firearm against anybody under any circumstances. I think I would say that.
And you were also saying earlier that you do let people know now that you're, you know, about your pacifism in World War II. That does this mean that you speak out more against war? Are you active?
No, not really. I belong to McCanwy, which is the medical campaign against nuclear warfare. I do belong to that, but I'm not a very active person in it. On the whole, I find my plate's full enough without doing... I do too many things, really, that's what it boils down to. But I subscribe to it, and I go occasionally to their meetings. Our daughter Pippa is the great one for that now, and she it was that has pushed me into that and into Greenpeace. I'm a member of Greenpeace too, which is, I think, all part of the same kind of way of thinking.
Is that a new development, do you think, the sort of environmental...
Oh, I think it's taking on, yes, I think so. And I think it'll be very interesting in this European election, which is next Thursday, isn't it, I think, that I think is going to be an enormous increase in support for the Green parties. And, you know, they're all jumping on the bandwagon, but there's only the one that is non-political and just devoted to green issues. So, yes, I'm very much in favour of that.
Yeah. Yes, it seems to be a new strand of the sort of anti-war, doesn't it? The green aspect.
Yes. I don't know that whether it is intrinsically anti-war, but I think it has to be, really. But it doesn't actually proclaim itself as pacifist, does it? But, I mean, if you're going to be green, you can't let off atomic radiation all over the place, can you? Or burn enormous quantities of aircraft fuel or rocket fuel around. So, I mean, it all goes, doesn't it?
I think, finally, you know, the final word on China, you know, with the situation today.
During the actual time that they were occupying Tiananmen Square, I could sort of visualize. I thought it was absolutely marvelous to think that they were all out there, in sometimes up to a million of them out there, absolutely peaceful. And I thought, well, you know, there's got to be a reaction somehow. And then the soldiers came in and started sitting down and talking to me. I thought, gosh, they're going to, this is coming. And to have what happened, it really disgusts me. It disgusts and horrifies me. I think that I'm glad that President Bush has come out absolutely straight and said that we're not going to deal with this regime. I think Maggie Thatcher damn well ought to have done so too, and I can't think why she hasn't. I would have thought that we could have said to them, we aren't going to do any more dealings over Hong Kong until you recognise the democratic progress. But then, interestingly enough, only yesterday I put this to somebody who I met over at a little party, and they said, did you know that, in fact, the whole of Hong Kong's water supply comes from mainland China. I said, no, I didn't know that. So now I can understand why. We can't fool around with Hong Kong. And I couldn't make out really why it was that the government was going to make it easier for people to come out of Hong Kong. I would have thought they should have said, we're going to make it easier for you to stay in Hong Kong by refusing to say we'll hand over. But now I can see, I thought we held the trump card, and I think they do. Yes, I realise that now, yes.
Well, Pat, thank you very much indeed for telling me so many very interesting experiences.
It's been living. There's a mass more I could have. The things I could have thought about and